Welcome to Four Glasses to Finish. I'm Dave.
And I'm Ray.
And this is a podcast where we drink four glasses of wine.
And we try to finish them.
Welcome back to another episode of Four Glasses to Finish. Today's episode topic is Chardonnay.
Ooh.
And before we get into which Chardonnay wines that we will be drinking, we have chosen four Chardonnays. We really have to talk about how Chardonnay is made. And one of the things about Chardonnay is people call it the winemaker's wine, the wine for winemakers. So we'll give a bit of explanation for why it's called that. But to begin with, there are two big things that we need to discuss when discussing Chardonnay. One of them is MLF, or malolactic fermentation. So all you wine nerds, take out your pen and pencil. And if you don't care about this stuff, you should fast forward about 10 minutes. and the other thing we need to talk about is how you can ferment Chardonnay and age Chardonnay, whether it's steel or oak. So I'm going to begin first talking about malolactic fermentation, and then Ray's going to talk about the difference between steel and
oak. I thought I was just going to drink the wine.
Well, maybe, yeah, like, it's kind of like a tease. It's like, I just want to drink it. It's right there, because we did pour the first glass
already. I know, I'm very thirsty. I'm so dry, and I'm very excited for today. And Chardonnay is a great grape to pick for, you know, refreshment.
Yes.
I mean, in some cases. We're going to actually see whether or not that holds true with the other Chardonnays, but...
And I think a lot of fun went into... We had a lot of fun even just discussing what this... episode of Chardonnay would be. So
it was still wondering what it's going to be.
So we'll figure it out, I guess, eventually. So to begin with, let's discuss really quickly what malolactic fermentation is. So what malolactic fermentation is, it's a process that happens during fermentation. During fermentation, the sugar or the yeast eats the sugar, and that gets converted into alcohol. That alcohol is that natural byproduct of yeast eating the sugar. What also happens during fermentation is malolactic fermentation. Now, in all grapes, there is an acid present called malic acid, and that's the same acid that's
like
present
apples.
In apples. So, you know, I know Italian, mela means apple, so malo, mela, it's the same Latin root for apple. And that malic acid during that fermentation process gets converted into lactic acid. And lactic acid is the same acid that's present in cream, butter, milk. And I don't know if you've heard this before, but it's kind of a standard to say, oh, I like a buttery Chardonnay. And there's not butter in the wine, but there is lactic acid, because lactic acid is a natural byproduct of fermentation.
Do you ever hear anybody say Kerrygold, specific like butter,
okay,
or something
like Irish
name
stuff,
it and be like, because I will tell you, there's so much different than like Land O'Lakes. Yeah. So
Kerrygold butter.
I've never heard anybody
great.
Though talk about Chardonnay as I really like it to taste like Kerrygold.
No, we should. People should.
I might do that.
My grandfather, he, God rest his soul, Italian through and through, but he would. You know, no matter how much pasta he ate or whatever, he would always...
I was
always,
hoping you weren't going to say butter.
No, no,
like,
he
that's
would say
just
nothing,
disgusting.
He would say nothing is better than bread and butter.
Oh, yeah.
That was, I mean, and it's great. And that's, you know, it's present in Chardonnay. So I guess while we drink these Chardonnays, we'll be like, this one's got Kerrygold. This is Land O'Lakes. What other butters are there? I guess...
Isn't it Plugra is like another one that's very high up there?
We should find...
Butter fat content.
Get the tasting sheets for those up here too. So it's really the reason, one of the reasons why Chardonnay is, you know, the winemaker's wine is because the winemaker can choose how much malolactic fermentation they want to do. They can bring it to 25% mallow, 50% mallow, or 100% mallow. And there are a lot of choices that go into that. that we will discuss throughout the course of this episode. But it's really up to the discretion of the winemaker and whether the grapes have enough acidity or too much ripeness. They can choose to tone down or to tone up how much malolactic fermentation they want to do. So Ray, what does malolactic fermentation bring to a wine? Because first of all red wine mostly goes through malolactic fermentation. But what does malolactic fermentation actually bring to a wine?
Well, there's a few things that it brings to a wine. The number one is in terms of mouthfeel. Malolactic is converting, the malic to the lactic acid, which is actually a acid that is, quote unquote, less acidic. So your pH of your wine will actually rise. Remember, pH is inverse to the acidity level when you go and convert it from malic to lactic.
And what is pH? pH is the acid.
Well, the technical name of what they're doing and testing when they're doing pH, it's like something around, I think it's hydrogen atoms in there. But, that is not my forte whatsoever. My forte is in drinking the stuff.
Yeah, not the chemistry behind it.
So but I will tell you, if you think about it, water's 7 pH. Almost all your wine is between 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. And then, the acid levels. And this, while they don't do this with Chardonnay, as far as I'm aware of, fermentation with, clusters, whole clusters and stems, that does a very similar thing in terms of raising the pH and lowering the acidity level. Although the perception of acidity in your mouth can sometimes be perceived differently from the standpoint of, it's a higher acid or a lower acid. On a technical basis, but when you actually perceive it in your mouthfeel, it actually seems like it's more balanced. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what's going on with the malolactic, along with the flavor components. And the flavor components that I think when most people think about malolactic is the butter, mm-hmm. which, the butter component is coming from a byproduct of the malolactic fermentation called diacetyl. Mm-hmm. And diacetyl, you can think of it like a bell curve. So, if you started out the malolactic fermentation, the diacetyl is very low. It's building up. It gets some sort of peak. And then as it closes off towards the finishing of the malo, the diacetyl starts to fall back down. And if you, at any point in time, you can stop that by just, adding SO2, essentially stopping the malolactic fermentation from proceeding.
Can temperature also stop
fermentation? You can, but then you have the worry of if you didn't do something to, really stop it, well, it could in theory start back up and then you have it fermenting in your bottle and you probably don't want that.
Nope.
so sulfur
is the short bet.
Yeah, you'd
stop.
Probably add sulfur. There's other products that they can put into the winemaking to kind of stop that. But, that's a decision point for the winemaker to actually produce a wine that has more buttery characteristics. Mm-hmm. You can stop it where it hits its highest diacetyl point and, go ahead and the mallow there. Mm-hmm. And that's going to come off completely different than a wine that goes 100% through mallow, mm-hmm. Like fully completes it. And the diacetyl actually gets broken down into other byproducts, which are much more softer and milder. And you're thinking more like typical Burgundy, where it's more like roasted nut and softer
flavors. I need to drink
flavors.
More Burgundy because, I've had probably like 6 bottles of like Premier Cru Burgundy, not much. But I do want to say, so when you, if a grape is super ripe, then you maybe the winemaker could choose not to do 100% mallow to kind of balance that. And the inverse of that, if the grape is if the Chardonnay's picked up or harvested when it's still, it's not super ripe, there's still a lot of natural acidity left in the grape, then you want to maybe do a higher level of malolactic fermentation to balance that acidity.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So it's not unusual for, while I think it's, oftentimes somewhat misconstrued, but, there's an awful lot in Chablis that actually goes through mallow, and it makes perfect sense because their acidity levels are, very high compared to a lot of other producing areas of Chardonnay. And they want to try to soften that acidity and not make it so bracing. But then you look at a place like Argentina or Australia, and even some California producers like Farniente, I believe, does this, where they actually will stop the Malo. And the reason they're doing it is because they're getting, you know, 14% alcohol, big ripe fruit, and they're not getting the acidity that you're getting in Chablis. And they don't want to take any of that acidity away, given that they already have, you know, less acidity to start with. So they'll stop the malolactic. You know, we're talking about this, but this brings up a small topic and a pet peeve of mine, which is the tech sheets on these things could be made better. So if you're listening out there and you have any influence on the tech sheets wine for your makers, wine, make them better people. Because trying to find out whether or not it a went wine through went what? Through Malo, was Surly's aged, Batonnage,
so,
did it see oak, what type of oak? And I'm like, some of these things are common problems, but given how, as Dave was saying, it's a winemaker's wine, there's so many decision points that can be done, and
they're not on the tech sheet. Maybe that's like the winemakers being like, I want to keep my secret. Yeah, I don't want people to know.
I think that's what it is.
Because
it's like your secret's not that good.
Yeah.
In some
so I did work at a winery, and on our tech sheets for our Chardonnay,
we don't do anything.
No, we would say, it would say 50% Malo. It would literally specify the percentage. But just to say what Ray's referencing to our tech sheets, some of them just say partial Malo, and that's like, well, how partial? Like,
and some of them don't say whether it went through Malo or not Malo.
It could be 99% partial. Like, we don't know. So I think at this point, we can start discussing the how in what vessel can the winemaker choose to ferment and age Chardonnay. It's either going to be in stainless steel or oak or a combination of both. So
or concrete.
Or concrete, that's right. But I don't think any of the... any of the wines we chose?
I don't think anything that we have here today, maybe except for the secret wine.
So, yeah, I should have said this in the beginning. But so we have four wines, three wines.
Dave's talking a lot, and I'm so thirsty. I'm going to take some sips right now. So
go ahead. We have three wines that we chose that represent the different styles of aging and malolactic fermentation. But then we have a fourth wine that we don't know how it's made. Ray and I are going to put our deductive tasting skills to the test.
And look like a fool afterwards.
And we're going to apply everything that we talked about and see if we can use those skills to deduce how that wine was made. And our producer, Ray's better half, is going to show us the tech sheet of that wine.
Show us how wrong we were.
Yeah. Hopefully we get a couple things right, but we'll see.
I'm hopeful, but I'm not going to lie and think that it's likely. So on the oak front, yeah, I mean, fermentation, can be done in steel vessels, concrete vessels, oak vessels. The decision of the oak vessel as to whether it's new or, you know, previously used and how previously used, is that 2 years, 3 years, four
years?
And if
it's previously used, it's not going to impart as nearly as much.
Yeah. You know, I remember at a tasting event where, you know, this kind of stuck in my head was, the idea that oak, influence on the wine tends to decrease at like 20% each year. So by the fifth year, it's like
done.
Truly
neutral,
pretty neutral.
Yeah.
But you know, you're still getting a 2 years old oak is still, you know, 50% of the value of the oak. And you know, I don't know if value is the right word, but influence is probably
influence.
So, you know, they have that decision. And, you know, the biggest one out of those one, you know, options, I think, is if you are going to do it in oak in the aging process, then doing it in oak for the fermentation process, while you would think is, you know, more time in oak, isn't that going to influence it more? It actually, the fermentation in the vessel changes how it, you know, takes on the oak, and it ends up being more integrated in many cases. Mm-hmm. And more, you know, I think more approachable is probably the best word for my personal palate.
Yeah.
On the aging front, you can make decisions on the length of time and, the use of, the barrel selection, whether or not it's, you know, a barrique or whether it's a Foudre or it's a,
they're all different sizes.
You know, yeah, they're all different sizes, puncheons. And then, you know, you can also age just in the steel vessels or the concrete vessels as well. So there's a lot of options there. You have differences if you go on the oak path around toast levels, the producer of the cooperage that you're using for the toast, yeah. Where you're sourcing the wood. Is it American? Is it French? Slovenian. Is it Slovenian?
There's so many
there's
things
so
to
much
consider.
Options. And you know, a lot of these options are not dedicated to Chardonnay. I mean,
yeah. This is just wine making in general.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that these things are in red wine all over the place. Mm-hmm. But for a white wine, this is not nearly as you know, typical to see them going into oak vessels or oak aging. And you know, there does impart a tannin structure to it via doing that if you're going to go use, you know, oak as your vessel. So that does make it different too. I think the other thing that is interesting about, you know, Chardonnay is the versatility that we see with styles, not only in the winemaking decisions, but, you know, it's not uncommon to find skin contact Chardonnay or sparkling Chardonnay. So you really have the whole gamut. The only thing I don't think I've seen all that often, if ever, is a dessert Chardonnay. But I'm sure somebody's doing it out there. So
late harvest Chardonnay.
Yeah, late harvest Chardonnay. Botrytis Chardonnay. So,
Botrytis Chardonnay. Yummy.
Ice wine Chardonnay. Yeah. I'm sure somebody's
got
to be doing it.
Fingerlace.
I can't say that I've had one myself, and if I have, I was
you
too drunk
know.
At the
you
time to remember
yeah.
it.
So we have, Ray talked about the oak, but you know, not all white wines can actually be aged in oak because they don't have enough structure or strong enough structure in the wine to be able to like withstand oak aging. So most white wines are aged in steel, we can say, right? So it's either going to be steel or oak. And that steel, if it's aged in steel, it really doesn't impart any flavor at all. It has no effect on the wine. And steel-aged wines are usually higher in acid, typically. So when Ray and I taste these Chardonnays, we're going to be looking for that. How high is this acid? How low is this acid? If it's a lower acid wine, we're going to deduce or think that maybe it's going to be an oak. Aged or oak fermented wine. If it's higher in acid, we're going to assume that it's probably in steel. And a lot of the components of oak are going to be made prominent when we smell them.
Should also mention one other thing, which is the lees aging itself. So, you know, it's also not unusual for Chardonnay to see what they call surly aging, which is essentially just aging it on the fine lees.
Which is the byproduct of fermentation, when the yeast eats the sugar, those cells die, and those dead yeast cells are called lees.
Yep.
And that adds flavor. So in some wines, you'll get that smell. It'll be like almost bready because yeast is also in bread. So
that brings up the good point of, you know, when you're thinking about yeast and the lees aging process, and remember this lees aging may be very passive, where they basically just like allow the wine to sit on top of the lees and, you know, more or less get some influence from the lees and some protection from the CO2 release to keep it reductive. Or this could be very active, where they're, you know, actually stirring it up and batonnage, and which is the stirring of the lees. Mm-hmm. The frequency at which they're doing it, just like you do pump overs in red wine, you know, batonnage and white wine can be done really frequently, or it could be done none at all. Whether or not it's getting racked off of the lees, how frequently it's getting racked, and all these things impact how much the lees has an influence on the wine's taste. And I think that's kind of difficult because lees, some of the same things that you get from lees, which is, you know, kind of a bready brioche
croissant.
But when you think about that, it's like, wait, brioche and a croissant, I mean, they're got like a butteriness, but doesn't butter from malolactic? So do they have to be one?
So
and it's like,
similar.
No, they
yeah.
don't.
Yeah.
You can choose them individually. You could choose to do a ton of batonnage, but stop the malolactic. And yeah. You could put it in the steel and
possibilities
have,
are endless with this.
Have Mallow. And yeah. and I think that's what makes it very difficult from a tasting perspective to kind of figure out yeah. what exactly it went through, because some of these characteristics show up in the wine's perception on the palate as, you know, very similar to one another, and deciphering which one it actually is a Sherlock Holmes case yeah. study.
It's funny. We should have worn our detective hats, our double brim.
I don't
hat.
Own one, so actually I do have a bowler hat. I'm kind of a hat nerd, so I do have a lot of hats.
We can
and,
get a pipe. You have a pipe?
But
we
I don't
do
have, you know what? I think I do Ooh. From an old Halloween costume.
There you go. Were you Sherlock Holmes?
I say old Halloween costume. It's like, well, you probably were wearing it 3 years. How old is it?
Confirmation from your producer. All right. So speaking of tasting, let's get into it. This is our first wine. This is from Domaine Pinson. This is a 2021 Chablis. So, Ray has been tasting throughout the course of speaking and...
More like drinking.
Yeah, but. Drinking. So I think I've tasted this too. I mean, it's like, it's golden. It's like yellow gold. It's beautiful, you know.
Yeah, it's a, I would say like a light strawish color.
Yeah.
I mean, smell is really crisp, very fresh.
Like
not getting butter.
Not
here.
At all. Very apple, crisp, fresh, even refrigerated apples on the nose.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I know some people hate the word mineral, but it is very crystalline. I don't know. Is that a better way?
It's hard. I mean, everything that we say about what we smell, we say it smells like, it tastes like. It's all metaphor. It's all simile. So... we're trying to compare it to something, and sometimes the metaphors fall short. But mineral makes sense.
You know, sometimes I think that we should describe wine based on scenes. I feel like, you know, like it smells like entering a foggy forest with the edges of the cliff and the ocean sounds, and you're like, you're picturing, I've been to something like this. And I kind of remember the smell and the feeling it gave you. And it's like, the wine can kind of do that.
Yeah.
But then...
it does transport you places.
Some poor folk in the middle of the country, like Iowa or something, he's like, I've never left the cornfield. And it's like, I don't know what it smells like.
Or
with
if we're in South Jersey, sometimes we never leave South Jersey. Like, I don't know. I never go to the mountains.
We could say it's the garbage truck you drove behind for 2 hours in traffic. And it's like, I don't know what that smells like. I've never had 2 hours worth of traffic. It's like, well, you're not missing anything.
It's just South Jersey. Don't worry about it. I mean, they do call us the Garden State for a reason. There are beautiful
aspects. We smell like petunias.
And other things.
But yeah, it's very... you know, when I smell it, I think I'm smelling the smell of a, you know, cool running water or, you know.
River rock,
wet stone.
Very clean, crisp.
Very clean, crisp, yep. And almost like when, if you've ever smelled the inside of a steel container that really didn't hold anything that was like soda or something where it's going to have a residue there. But it has like this smell that, you know, a very clean coin, maybe.
It's almost, but too, I always say, like
hard to find
clam
those clean
shell.
Coins.
It's like a clean coin, yeah. Like a clamshell. Like it's, there's like a salinity to it as well.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, it makes me want to eat clams or oysters right now.
Oh my God, exactly. So let's talk about how this wine is made, just to, you know, just to say how it's made and how it I guess, manifests itself in the glass. So we got, this was made with 100% steel, stainless steel, aged. And we really don't have anything on here about MLF, that malolactic
fermentation. But I did look up on a few websites, and it did seem to suggest that it did go through mallow, which is not, you know...
It didn't say how much.
No, they would have went through completely.
So it's 100%.
Yeah, because a lot of times when they're doing them separate, it's not like you're kind of you know, cutting it halfway. I mean, that's being done for trying to get certain, you know, diacetyl and stuff like that. But it's more through doing it in different vessels. So you might have, you know, five tanks of wine and three of them go through it and two of them don't. And then you just do the math of three out of five, you know, went through it, and that's your percentage.
Yeah.
Or you could use different vessels, and I think the wine we're going to taste later, I'm going to guess that maybe the steel one didn't and the oak one did. And then when they combined them, it was 50-50 or yeah, whatever, partial.
We'll get there,
we don't know what the word partial means.
Mm. I know, we know. It's up to your imagination.
You know, yeah. So I'm going to imagine it's in the same ratio that they're doing the aging. But, you know, it could be 10%, 90%. I don't know.
But something that we...
Fix those tech sheets, please.
Yeah, for all the wine nerds out there who can't sleep at night because they don't know the percentage of malolactic fermentation.
I know. Well, that could be the whole thing. It's like they know you can't sleep at night. So, like,
keep the mystery alive.
They're going to need to drink more to get to bed.
Yeah.
And it's like a whole vicious cycle.
It's a marketing scheme. There it is. That's how they catch you. It's like the equivalent of, like, Life cereal putting chemicals in there. Hey, I'm sorry, Life. I don't know if they did that or not. I'm just... Yeah, well, yeah. They didn't give us any money, so I can say what I want.
Poor Life. How did they get involved here?
I actually love Life cereal. It's delicious.
The original. It's those chemicals.
Yeah. But I something that we will not get into on this episode, because we'll probably devote a whole episode or a whole season, if we release these in seasons, is terroir. But the soil here is classic Kimmeridgian soil, so that also does affect the body and the mouthfeel. But we won't get into that. We'll discuss that for another pod.
Well, you know, one thing that is interesting about terroir, though, in the discussion is how it somewhat is contradictory to Chardonnay being a winemaking wine, you know, winemaker's wine, where it's like, okay, well, where does terroir end and the winemaker's imprint begin? And Chardonnay is a grape that's really difficult to pinpoint that.
Well said.
You drink a lot of these and you know, take pretty much any area. I think Chablis is kind of the exception to the rule in that you drink Chablis and, you know, while there's some differences between Petit Chablis and Premier Cru and Grand Cru, mm-hmm. but I feel like the differences are much smaller than if you were going to take, let's say, you know, Sonoma Chardonnay. And it's like, well, what is Sonoma Chardonnay? Because there's tons of producers, and producers are doing, even within one producer, they're doing, you know, two or three different styles of Chardonnay.
And that's like the wild, wild west in you know, in the new world. You could do whatever you want. Is, you know, there are certain laws you got to follow, but it's not like Chablis or Burgundy that are so terroir driven, where there are literal laws dictating how a wine is made.
The other thing of interest is, I don't know if this saw much Lees aging. I know in some vintages, certain producers do leave it on the Lees, but they don't do any stirring. Mm. There are a few that actually do stirring, but it's pretty rare.
But not as much so as batonnage.
I would say that if they do keep it on the Lees, which, again, tech sheet does not tell me.
Keep it on the Lees. Dude, that has to be a phrase that we say.
That should be a shirt. Yeah, keep it on the Lees.
like keep it on the DL. Like, keep it on the Lees, man. Like, let it hang.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, just be cool, man. Keep it on the Lees. I love that. It came with a bumper sticker or something.
This is...
I love that.
It's very fresh.
So, yes, this is steel. Like we said,
it's steely.
Yeah, it's Steely Dan.
Steely Dan.
Steely Shard.
Yeah, Steely Shard.
Maybe that's they were Shard. Wine drinkers. Maybe Steely Dan was just a bunch of wine drinkers. But yeah, so I think the aging vessel, how it was made, I think it's present in the glass for sure.
Yeah, I would say so. And I think, you know, even though, you know, going back to tech sheet, you failed me, but I think that Chablis is sometimes difficult just because of how pristine and, you know, lean and crisp the wine is, and so you suspect that, you know, it basically was untouched, it's all steel or something. And granted, you know, not every single one's quite like that, but an awful lot of them are. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think it's sometimes surprising to find out that they actually do seem some, you know, production, and kind of makes me wonder what would happen if you didn't do any of those things. Like if you just, you know, didn't go through mallow, you did it all stainless steel, like would it be rip your face off acidity or who knows? Yeah. But it does make it difficult when you consider, you know, other wines from other areas where they go through a similar process, but because of, you know, getting higher ripeness or, you know, impacts in the actual growing process on the grapes, they just show off as being much more influenced from the winemaking part than I think, you know, Chablis does. So
yeah,
kind of interesting.
So now that we've discussed all that, do you like it?
I do. Well, I'm a Chablis nut. I'm a Chablis whore. Mm-hmm. And
that's what I'll get you for your birthday.
Chablis whore, I want more.
So if I buy you a gift of Chablis, Ray, will you interpret that as something more?
My production person. but no, I think... I just love how lean and crisp it is, and it tends to go with a lot of things that I tend to eat, which is seafood and you know, clams, oysters.
So I do want to say
I'm an otter, essentially. That's what I'm. I'm basically I'm sitting here saying that I'm like I'm describing an otter. So why am I
Ray the otter?
I crack most of them up on my belly while I'm sitting in bed. This is like complete slob.
But I do want to say too, there, you know, some people who say, oh, I hate Chardonnay. I don't drink Chardonnay. Typically, in my experience, people say that about buttery Chardonnays. So for anyone who is not into a buttery Chardonnay, this, like, you should drink Chablis. I could drink all day, every day. It's such a pleasant wine. It's super fun. There's so much to it, but it's so approachable and just easy to drink. And like you said, food friendly, goes with tons of stuff. So I will this is my first time actually having Domaine Pinson, and I would buy it again. I would definitely buy this again.
And I would drink it again if you brought it over.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what, Ray? You might get lucky one day. We'll see.
You're going to have to bring a Grand Cru, though, for lucky.
Good point. So... we are getting ready to try our second wine. So this is from a producer in Alto Adige in northern Italy called Terlan, T-E-R-L-A-N. And this is their Cruth Chardonnay, K-R-E-U-T-H, Cruth Chardonnay. And yeah, Chardonnay is not an Italian grape. So this is not under the DOCG. Etiqueta or label, it's under the DOC, because since it's not indigenous to Italy, it's not under the DOCG. But yeah, let's get into it, man.
Well, I mean, for one, it's more yellow than
It's Chablis. A much darker, more and golden than the other one.
The smell is distinctively different.
God, it's very different. I mean, I feel like I'm smelling like clams and butter sauce, like a butter wine sauce. Not quite a Kerrygold yet, I would say.
This is Land O'Lakes all the way.
Lol. LOL.
It's weird because I'm like trying to figure out, is it more cheesy or dairy, or is it more of a beer, yeast, bread? Or is it more of a, you know, oak, like that slight smell of soft oak, which when you're just smelling like a little bit, if you've ever been down in a cellar, you know, you get that cellar smell of oak barrels, and it has this like sweet, almost vanilla cream smell. And, you're not tasting any wine yet. You're just sitting down in the barrel room. And like that smell can oftentimes almost make you think like, you know, French vanilla or something like that, which again, kind of is why it's somewhat confusing picking apart Mallow versus oak influence versus Lee's influence. But I don't know. I feel like,
and I will be honest though, I think the nose on this is not nearly as strong as the Domaine Pinson. I feel like I find myself needing to breathe or like smell deeper in order to get more aromatics here.
Yeah, the more I smell, the more I actually think it smells more like bread than it does a dairy product.
I totally get the bread and the yeasty stuff, but I do get like a little bit of green. I get a little bit of dill. I don't know if you get dill on here at all, but I definitely get a little bit of a green note on this.
Pickles. Yeah.
Dill pickles. Kosher dill.
Kosher
baby.
Dills.
But this wine is 50%. So the reason why Ray and I chose these wines is because we have the first wine is 100% steel. This wine is 50% oak, 50% steel, and partial Mallow. So again, we have to interpret that. And then the third Chardonnay that we will be picking is 100% oak. So we wanted to give, represent all or as many styles as we could in three wines. So we tried to our best to do that. And it's very clear that this has oak on it already. Like as Ray said, with the color and, clearly with the mouthfeel and with the aromatics.
I feel like it's got a lot of Lee's character. Like there's a lot of bread. It reminds me of like if I smelled not the sourdough bread, but yeah. Like a brioche or better yet, like Alana's grandmother used to make little, dinner buns. And it reminds me of that where it's like, yeah, there's a butteriness to them, but there's really not like uber amounts of butter in the dinner roll until I get it and cut it open. Then there's going to be a uber amounts of butter. But prior to that, there's just a little bit. And it just has such a lovely, like, bready smell that you just, I don't know, it makes me hungry. That's what it kind of does. Yeah. Which, in here, that I think that's something that you don't oftentimes think about too is like, smells when you're smelling something in the kitchen, somebody's making a great dinner, you start to salivate from the smells. Mm-hmm. And that salivation can change your perception of the acidity in the wine because you're already, what does acidity do to you? It makes you salivate. If you're already salivating because the smell is enticing you, it's like you're going to be amped up to kind of like find that wine even more, potent and approachable. Than if you, smelled something that was kind of off-putting. I wouldn't say off-putting, but kind of bland and really wasn't, making you salivate beforehand. So I think some of that is the wine, but some of it is the smell of that, dinner roll is very enticing.
I definitely, I think like you said, the difference between Lee's and oak is hard to pinpoint.
And it does say on here, big wooden barrels for 50, which I'm going to guess.
It's 10 months lease, so that's not a small amount of time, too.
No. And I don't know if they're new barrels or old barrels, but my guess is that they are not new. I mean, there's like, if they are using new, it's got to be really, really small.
Yeah.
But, on big wooden barrels, if they were neutral, I would imagine that the only thing that it's really going to impart significantly is in the oxidation of the wine, it's just giving a little bit more roundness to it.
Yeah.
When we drank the other one, it was 100% steel. And when we were drinking that, it was steely. It was very lean and crisp and it cut. This one is rounder.
It has some of the crisp.
Yeah, it's crisp still, but not nearly the crispness that the Chablis had. And but yet it's still lean, and it's has this lovely, that lovely bread smell. So it does remind me more of food than it does like a wet stone. Although clearly bank. Based on the fact that that Chablis went pretty quick.
Yeah.
I must like myself. To eat rocks. In the last episode, I was
talking about gasoline
on the weekends. And I guess my other favorite pleasure is eating rocks.
Hey, dude, let's go. You live right near the...
I'm not going to have teeth very soon. This is right a problem.
A creek right here. We should go in the riverbed and start licking some rocks down
I'm
there.
I'm going to try to avoid... Although it does bring up some side memory of this girl in like kindergarten. And she'd eat like little pebbles. Ray. She would eat pebbles.
Oh, man.
And people would give her little pebbles and she'd like eat them.
Yeah.
Like a chicken or something. I never did it. No. I never ate them, nor did I give her little pebbles because the whole time I was like, I don't think we're supposed to be eating those. I don't know what they do to you, but I don't think they digest.
She probably shit bricks after that.
Surely. That's essentially what a brick is, right? It's like little pebbles, sand. It's
stone lit,
with
stone
a binder.
Oops, she did.
Sorry.
So I got to say, too, my son, speaking of rocks and pebbles, my son...
He's eating them now, too?
Well, he's not eating them. No. I will not allow
him. After daddy.
I don't know who this girl's parents were, but I will not allow my son to eat pebbles, but he does collect rocks. See, like, we have, like, all over our yard, he has piles of stones and rocks everywhere. And when I'm drinking wine, I always say, Sammy, can you smell this wine? And I go, what does it smell like? And he goes, acai. Smells like outside. So he's not wrong about that. I think when we talk about smelling wine, it should be like, smells like outside. Because that's what we're saying.
Like,
but where outside? That's
well, not the garbage truck.
Not New Jersey.
But it does have a nice roundness to the mouthfeel. And the, aromatics itself, while I wouldn't call this complex, but it is very enticing.
Mm-hmm.
It has that, lovely, leasy, bready smell. I'm thinking brioche.
Yeah. But I do think it's really good to specify and to really individuate the differences between the first and the second. Because like Ray said, there is more of a roundness to it. And it is darker. So whether that comes from aging it on the lees or have from the 50% oak. But I think it's really important to pinpoint those differences between the winemaking and how that comes out in the glass.
Another interesting thing, not that it really, per se has a ton of impact, I would think. Definitely has an impact on cost to produce. But both of these wines that we just had look like they're hand harvested.
Yeah.
So, I think that's something that's interesting. Why is that interesting? Because essentially you can choose to pick, the best berries and you can, take whole clusters or take just partial clusters. And there's just a degree of, something that can't be just replicated with having a mechanical harvester going down the vine row and just shaking the thing to take berries off. So I think that's something interesting. And in some of these cases,
going into
still a lot more care. And in some of these cases, I think they are doing whole cluster pressing, which whole cluster pressing, we didn't really talk too much about it, but whole cluster pressing tends to create wines that have less extraction of the skins phenols. So you're getting more free run juice essentially. And it's going to be a cleaner, leaner, product.
When you say less extraction, just less skin contact. The juice is pressed and bam.
It's less skin contact and you're essentially, taking the best part of the juice. Mm-hmm. Almost like when you're thinking about pressing, whether it's a bladder press or a direct press, typically you press to a certain amount of pressure bars and you're essentially extracting less of the bitter phenols that you'd get from, either the skins or stems or pedicels or whatever is in there that's not juice. And you're essentially extracting less of that because you're not pressing it as hard.
Yeah.
And by having it whole cluster pressed, those clusters of grapes kind of make it more difficult to press them that hard.
Yeah.
Keep some like air if you think about it,
Got it. Well, there you have it. That is the Terlan Cruth Chardonnay.
I took a sniff of the next one. So,
yeah, so did I.
It was quite different.
I don't know if while you were talking, I was like, I made a gesture to Ray how intense this is compared to the other Chardonnays. But I do want to say really quickly about like taste vocabulary, because I do think all these things that we're saying, or that, you know, are also experiential, because when, just like with language, when you have a word like chair, everyone associates that word, C-H-A-I-R, with the object chair. So the relationship between the object and the word is paramount to communicating. So if I say the word chair, but you have no reference point for chair, you're not going to know what the hell I'm talking about.
Are you making a case to use chair as a tasting?
No, I'm making a case.
This one smells like a chair.
For making,
with somebody who had a stinky ass in it. That's unfortunate.
Smells like leather chair. You don't really want that chair. The middle with the cushion coming out. Yeah. But I'm making a point that like when you are tasting or smelling wines, you have to develop a tasting vocabulary. It's challenging, but you need to be able to associate certain flavors and aromatics with something from your real life experience. You know, one of the things that's why, like, butter, we all know butter. So I think this third wine is a really easy way to build that association with the wine and a flavor or a taste, because it is so easily defined as butter. Like, so it's jumping from the glass.
The third wine that we're tasting is one that I think a lot of folks are aware of or have had, and that's the 2021 Chardonnay from Rumbauer.
So I actually have never had this wine.
So I have had
Please
it.
Please don't judge me.
But it's not very frequent, just because while I do think it is, you know, for what they're going for, which I think is this style, based on everything they're doing in the winemaking process, it is not a style that I generally go to. I go for that Chablis, crystalline, pristine, lean, yeah, clean, mean. Fighting machine. I go for that style. This one, so they do everything. This thing goes through 100% mallow.
100% oak.
It is on its lees. It's not only on its lees, but it does bâtonnage every 2 weeks. So you're getting tons of lees contact and stirring of the lees. You're aging it in American oak and French oak. And American oak obviously has stronger flavors, gives some of that coconut dill component. And they do it in 30% new oak. So I'm like, you can't really pick more things you could be attempting to do on the wine in order to impart a bold, round, ripe, fleshy, you know, flavor of basically butter and stone fruit and brioche. It's you know, it's got gobs of stuff going on, yeah, but gobs is probably the right word, because it is, and it's 14.5% alcohol. Big. So this is gonna, especially, you know, get you going. This is awesome.
You know what, Ray? Cheers, buddy.
See, I picked the one that, you know, like, what is Uncle Jemima's mash liquor? Mm. if you've ever watched the Saturday Night Live skit, you know what I'm talking about here. But essentially, this wine gets you done in for more for less, you know?
Mm. It's true. So, and I think all the things Ray was saying was, this is a much... I mean, I'm assuming that this sells pretty well.
You could totally taste the American oak influence,
yeah,
I think.
It's huge.
That is one thing that I'm
like...
It's
vanilla. It's just vanilla.
It's a vanilla, but it's a vanilla that is... I almost say like it's vanilla, but it's like a coconutty vanilla.
Yeah.
And that coconutty vanilla note, I'm like, when you taste that, the only other wines that jump to mind is like, you've got Ridge, Silver Oak, and Rioja. Mm-hmm. Like and Rioja is probably the one that jumps to mind the most, because with a lot of times Rioja, you know, it's not as tannic and bold as, you know, the Cabernets from Ridge, let's say, or Zinfandels from Ridge. So it's a little bit more supple. Mm-hmm. and you can approach it a little sooner. Plus, you know, they're releasing them, you know, 5+ years from vintage, so they're already getting a little bit of age when they come into the market. Makes them a little more approachable. But that unmistakable American oak signature on those wines, I kind of feel like I'm tasting it here. It's very, you know, well done, but it is a signature. So if you don't like American oak for some reason, you don't like Rioja, you don't like, and granted, these are red wines. Mm-hmm. Maybe you like it on red, you don't like it in white, but you totally find it here.
And I think it's funny going through the other wines. Like the first, the Chablis was crisp apple. I feel like the Terlan was more like applesauce or like stewed or baked apples. But then this, I don't get out. I get like pineapples, like roasted pineapple
is a great example.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like, so you can tell with how the fruit changes as, you know, the wine making
this is more tropical
fruit,
yes, for sure.
So I like on the nose, it's a lot of oak. I get a lot of that oak notes and the tropical fruit on there.
Yeah, I feel like it's a lot of tropical fruit, a lot of that coconutty American oak influence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they say what portion is American oak, but it, again, text sheets, they suck.
It's just 30% new is what
it just says. 30% new. And the new, I mean, you clearly get a lot of oak influence from that. So I'm like, whether it's mostly American oak is a new oak, or is it a 15-15, or what is the splits of new versus, you know, oak in terms of where it's coming from, whether it's the American or the French. But you can totally tell that this has significant oak influence. You can tell it's a riper fruit because you're getting that tropical notes. And you're also getting, while I wouldn't really, you know, the one thing I wouldn't say about this is I don't think it's super duper buttery. Mm. And
Yeah, I think it's
fresh.
More,
it's actually got pretty good acidity.
It's more oaky than buttery to me. I get more oak than butter notes at all in this, totally.
And maybe that's one of those things where it's like the butter is there, but it's like you went with the butter. So instead of saying I went high, you know, on the butter component, the diacetyl was cut off at its peak. But then I made a very lean wine otherwise, where I didn't give it botanage. I didn't do surly aging. I basically put it in all neutral oak, or I put it in stainless steel. So the only thing you notice is the butter component. They went the full fat hog. Mm-hmm. the oak, the new oak, the American oak, the mallow, the botanage. Doing the trifecta... I think they may have made a better wine than had they just done one of them and not the other two. I think you have to go like all the way on here, and it's a style preference for sure. I don't think everybody is going to jump for that, but you know, Rumbauer's very well known, so I think there's plenty of folks that like that style, and I think there's foods that I could imagine, you know, pairing this with that.
Well,
I'm like,
also
it could work.
Food pairing suggestions, and one of them is fettuccine. Like, I think like fettuccine Alfredo. Well, this one says fettuccine with salmon and asparagus, but I think like a fettuccine Alfredo would actually like
a lot of fat.
Yeah, you need that fat.
You pair it almost like you would do a Rioja.
Yeah,
essentially, it's like
Rioja. I do have to say, I think this is a very well crafted wine. It's for what it is. It's wonderfully made. It is not my favorite.
No, and it does have a sweetness to it on the tail end. Yeah. You know, their tasting note says ripe peach, citrus fruits, spice, and pie crust aromas. And I'm like,
spice.
Well, you know, I totally get the spice.
The
pie
crust
aromas is your
not
botanage.
Citrus. Do you get citrus?
I get some citrus. I mean, it's probably, you know, more in the acidity than I do like outright. Like if you told me it was a lemon, a pineapple with a little spritz of lemon on it, I'm like, I could buy that.
Yeah.
But the pineapple is what I'm noticing mostly. I'm noticing that the pineapple is more acidic than a typical pineapple.
Yeah.
Maybe. But I'm not smelling lemon.
It's not a super ripe pineapple. Speaking of pineapple, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but today I was walking. I went to...
You found a pineapple in New Jersey?
I did.
Holy shit. Dole's got a place in Jersey.
I went out to brunch with my wife. We we found ourselves alone today, so we went on a lunch date. But we're walking back to our car, and we were passing a cigar bar.
You know, you're not
bar.
Alone if you found each other.
No, I mean, just the meaning, it was just the two of us. We are never alone anymore. You know, we have my son, so he was in daycare today. So we took advantage and went out to lunch. But we're walking back to the car, and I was passing a cigar bar in the town we were in Haddonfield. And outside was one of the guys who works there, and he's a friend of mine. And he had like boxes of produce, and he one of the guys who was also there, he goes, "Hey Dave, do you want a pineapple?" And I was like, "Yeah, I want a pineapple. Well, of course I do." So I got a free pineapple, and I went home with
guy?
The pineapple. Yes, yeah,
I, okay. Yeah. Because it's a little weird. Yeah. I've never gone to a grocery store where they were just giving me free fruit.
No,
so
but like,
just...
it's just like crazy. Like what we're talking about pineapple, and I got a pineapple today. I should have brought that. We should have paired the pineapple with the Chardonnay.
Oh, sometimes I wonder if it's like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Dave walks down the street and like everybody knows him. Is like,
giving
Dave, here
stuff.
You go. I walk down the street and they're like, who is that guy?
Ray the Otter.
It's that Otter Man. It's Otter Man.
So,
it smells like oyster soup and cracking on his belly all the you know... We haven't yet entered the fourth glass.
No, we haven't. And this fourth glass is a wine that Ray and I, neither of us have had. And we are, like I said, we're going to try and deduce how it's made and if we can pinpoint any of those qualities. I think I'm up for the challenge. How are you feeling?
I'm ready.
Do you need like a massage, Ray? Do you need?
I'll take it if I'm
given it. Do you need like something to get ready?
I'll not say no.
Lessen your nerves.
It's funny, I keep going back to this Rumbauer, and I don't really, again, it's not my style, but it's, I think for the fact that it's so different from what I'm used to drinking, that it's somewhat a appealing mm-hmm. change of pace.
I finished my Chablis, by the way.
Well, I already finished mine, and I poured
more. And you're on your second
Chablis. I actually have five glasses.
Listen, my goal is to finish. I don't know if I'll finish the Rombauer because that's 14.5%.
Oh, come on, Dave.
Okay, I will.
Oh, okay.
So this wine, I need to give a shout out to the winemaker of this because I'm super excited. It doesn't happen really ever that I meet anyone who has a hand
except
in...
for grocery store.
Yeah, pineapple. Except for the...
people with pineapples. You meet some all the time
outside a cigar bar. I'm like, it's rare that I meet anyone that actually has a hand in winemaking. But just not to be too long winded. My wife and I in 2019 went out to Napa, and we tasted at Matthiessen, which is one of my favorite producers. And this wonderfully kind, sweet, patient woman, Audra Chapman, actually did hosted the tasting for us. And we've kind of sort of kept in touch throughout the years. Every time I would order wine from Matthiessen, Audra would take care of my order. Even if like I wanted something that wasn't part of my allotment, she would be like, yeah, I can put that on there for you. It was just really, really awesome customer service, really kind, treated me like a human. Really wonderful person, but she actually
of a who man,
yeah. But she started her own winery called Newfound Wines. And when she opened the winery, I reached out to her and I was like, "I need your wine." Just so I got, I think I ordered 5 bottles total. This is one of them, and this is her Chardonnay. And I've been waiting for a momentous occasion to open it, and. This is it, Ray. This is the momentous
occasion?
Yes, with you.
I feel so special.
I mean, I'm very excited to try this and to see what we can deduce from this. So our producer did give us the tech sheet, but it's face down. So let's go, Ray. So I would say color, it's a little golden. It's yellowy. It looks like the Terlan, I would say. It's not, I think it's a little darker than the Chablis.
It's hard because it's still a little colder than the other ones.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely.
And so this one is a little frosty.
That's my fault. I'm Producer's fault.
We forgive. We forgive her.
She's fired.
Oh, man. But it definitely on the nose is very crisp. Clean. I like the desert because it's clean. Lawrence of Arabia, anyone? So do you think, I feel like this is closer to the Terlan. It's a little darker than the Terlan, but it's closer to that. Oh. Did I? Was it something I said?
Yes, I'm going to blame you.
Blame me, Ray. Go ahead.
It was that dark Terlan note. No, Terlan. The Terlan, I would say, yeah, it's darker than the Terlan.
But not as dark as the Rumbauer.
Maybe not as dark as the Rumbauer, but I think it's close to the Rumbauer.
Oh, is that the Rumbauer right there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there they are labeled. It is close. It's not close. As dark, but it is close. You're right.
You know what? This one's also in a different cup, which is making it a little harder because, I mean, it's in a different chalice. So this one is a little higher up. And so looking at these wines next to each other, it just, I don't know. Clearly it's difficult for me at this point in time to look at wines are on different levels.
See, this is part of the podcast. It's four glasses to finish. When are we going to cross the finish line?
Now it's got me actually wanting to have lots of different cup sizes.
We could play like,
and that could go many ways, but
there we go.
But glass sizes, that's a more appropriate word.
It's like Miss Congeniality.
Yeah. So what do you smell?
So
good, sir.
It's hard because I'm looking for smells, you know, I'm looking, do I get oak? I'm looking for, do I get Christmas? Christmas? Crispness.
If you got Christmas on this, I'm like, wow.
Well, you know, cinnamon is part of oak and it's part of Christmas. So, I mean, I got to say, I think I do get oak on this. I don't get like nearly as much oak as the Rombauer, but there's got to be some oak on this.
It has a interesting nose. I can't tell. There's like a... It's weird because the nose and the palate do not sync for me on here. It's like the nose reminds me of like there's a vegetal component.
Mm.
Like a greenness or, you know, and not, this is not a harsh criticism, but almost like a, you know, rotting leaf or something like that. Lettuce or something. It's earthy. Like a... It's got a cabbagey note. That probably, but not like uber cabbagey, but just like a little bit of that funky cabbage note, I feel like.
Funky cabbage.
And but then when you taste it, it doesn't have any, like, as far as I can tell, I don't feel like it has any like aging notes, which normally I associate that like cabbagey aromatic to being a wine that's, you know,
aged. Yeah.
But I don't feel like it's still quite fresh. I wouldn't say it's in the same vein as the Chablis by any manner. It's not as over the top as the Rombauer. It's probably somewhere in between Rombauer and the Terlan.
Terlan.
That Terlan. Somebody's shutting this off right now, and he's like, that's not Terlan. Can't stand him saying that.
America.
This show's not for you, then.
I definitely think that I tasted the Terlan.
The Terlan.
And then I tasted the Newfound, and there's definitely similarities between the two. I think. I want to say this has to be some sort of combination of steel and oak. Or maybe neutral oak. So I think the benefit, too, of tasting four different Chardonnays is you can compare and contrast them in the glass what they look like, what they smell like, what they taste like. You know, having a context to compare it to is super helpful. But I don't know, man.
I think this sees Batonnage.
Mm. Yes, I don't
get
these.
It's not as round and, you know, tropical, I guess. Mm-mm. And that could also be the ripeness of the grapes as the Rombauer. On the other hand, I definitely notice oak on here.
Yeah, there's definitely oak.
It doesn't seem like super less oaky to me.
And I feel like the alcohol's got to be 13.5.
Yeah,
14.
I think it's got a decent amount of alcohol. Not as high as Rombauer, but probably higher than Terlan.
I would say Terlan. 13.5. Should we settle on 14?
14?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Settle on 14.
14.
Okay, 14%. Do we want to give a percentage?
Is that your final answer? Well, I think I'll say that's my final answer.
I think I want to say 14 too, because the tears on the glass fall kind of slowly, and they're pretty viscous. What do you think about the steel versus oak proportion? Would you say 50-50, 25-75? Or neutral oak? Would you say no steel? Because I'm kind of leaning towards neutral.
For some reason, I have a feeling it's going to be one of those things where it's like, there's no new oak, but there's a lot of like 2 or 3 year old oak where it's like, you know, it gives a lot of oak flavor, but it's technically no new. But I don't know.
You're probably
in terms of steel, I could see it fermenting in steel. I don't know how. I want to say that I don't think it's aging in steel.
But you want to say it's fermented in steel?
I'll say it's fermented in steel. It's aged in oak. It goes through mallow. There isn't any Batonnage. There is Lees, though. And there's no American oak.
Yeah. This is the pinnacle of this episode right here.
Like I could get fired right now.
This is momentous.
I may not be your host next week. If I fail here.
A lot.
Between
is hanging
Dave
on
and the
producer.
I may not be with us anymore.
But not only is this a wine that I've been waiting to try and open for, you know, a worthy enough situation such as this, but this is a big deal. We went through three different Chardonnays, and we're trying to apply all that knowledge and crap that we discussed to this glass. I'm gonna say, so you said, fermented in steel, aged in neutral oak or 2 or 3 year old oak. Lees, but no Batonnage. And did you make a call for mallow?
Yeah, mallow.
100%.
Hundo.
Hundo, baby. Yeah. All right, I'm going to say...
Benjamin, man.
I'm going to differ on a few points. I'm going to say that it's fermented in neutral oak. And I'm going to say... I'm going to agree with you. It's got like 2 to 3 year old oak, but also neutral.
Do you find the taste to be any like tropical notes on that?
The acid's pretty medium plus.
Good acidity, yeah.
If I had to say any tropical, would not say pineapple. I'm inclined to say more of a not ripe mango. Like not a soft mango. Because like not ripe mangoes can be super acidic.
I could see the mango. Honestly, I could have seen the pineapple too.
Do you get pineapple?
Not as much as on the Rombauer, but I do feel like I get a pineapple note too. I don't know. It just is. It seems pretty tropical to me.
I just think this does go through mallow. It's totally buttery, but it's pleasant. It's a little less than popcorn butter. It's It's like you got your Thomas English muffin with the nooks and the crannies, and you have just a little bit of melted butter on top with like a little pool in one of the nooks. Oh, man. A little egg on top.
Oh. Now I'm getting hungry.
All right. Should we do the grand reveal?
Yeah. Let's do it.
I'm nervous.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right. So here we go. Whole cluster. We didn't say that. 24 months.
Barreled into 2 Stockinger barrels and an Atelier cigar.
Oh, man.
Native yeast. Vigorous fermentation period. The wine was topped every few weeks. In the fall of 2020, each barrel was combined in one 300 steel tank where it received its first dose of SO2. You know, the producer could have done a better job finding more details. This tech sheet, as with most tech sheets, not up to my standards.
Ray is a stickler.
I don't see the notes about the mallow. I don't see notes about whether or not it had honeysuckle. What?
It's just notes of honeysuckle.
Oh, notes of honeysuckle. Yes, yes. Yeah. But I feel like, you know, it did go into. It says the juice was moved off the gross lees.
So there is
lees.
But it was removed.
And then now, yeah, I don't know. I feel like there is. And the interesting thing is it mentions the vigorous fermentation period, which I'm like, a hotter ferment is what that kind of tells me. And a hotter ferment probably is going to show off as being, you know, more tropical fruits, more ripe fruits, I think. So,
but also,
I don't know if that's the barrels, what they're kind of saying, or if they're also mentioning something there subliminally around mallow.
Barrels, I do want to say the barrels are bigger. 600 liter and 300 liter.
Yeah,
so,
it doesn't say if they're new or old or how old they are. But
I think we can also say about the bigger the barrel, the less.
But Stockinger barrels, I mean, they were only imported into the States within the last, I think, 10 years.
I didn't know
so
that.
I'm like, they can't be that old.
Yeah, but the bigger the barrel, isn't it true that the bigger the barrel, the less the barrel imparts its flavor? Or is that not true?
Yeah, the less volume of the more volume of wine to the, you know, barrel, volume of barrel,
the less of the
less impact of the oak
so
barrel on.
Maybe that's why we were talking about neutral or like 2 to 3 year.
Yeah,
barrels.
I kind of feel like the barrel age is probably not really neutral because I don't think it's a 5 year old barrel or more.
Yeah. So, and
but it is a big barrel, which would impart less oak. So I'm like, I don't think it's new. But I don't think it's really neutral.
Yeah.
But it is big. And the combination of a, like, you know, previously used but not neutral with a big barrel, it probably is what's creating the perception of oak, but not to the extent that the Rombauer has. I just wish it said something about, you know, how they treated the fine lees on there. Did they do any matinage? Did they do any...
Yeah.
I mean, they did talk a little bit about the racking part here.
Yeah.
It says the barrel élevage lasted 24 months without racking. So that's a lot of time on its lees.
Mm-hmm.
24 months on fine lees. That's
so that gave it a lot of its texture.
Yeah.
But I will say, you said stainless steel fermented. I said barrel fermented in neutral. So none of us were right.
I don't know. Does it say where it was fermented?
Yeah, it was... The juice was then moved off the gross lees and barrel. Oh.
Yeah, so I don't know if they actually say where it was fermented.
Because
at that point, it's already been fermented, and then they're putting it into barrel. So I'm like, I don't know. It doesn't say that. But so then they put it back into barrel.
They put it back
into the stainless steel tank
to stop the
SO2,
fermentation.
And then probably going to bottling and blending, you know.
It stayed for 6 months. What a choice to keep it in stainless steel 6 months after it was aged for 24 months in barrel. That's an interesting choice.
I don't know. I would say that we did pretty good on that.
I'm
impressed with myself,
so
honestly.
I am too, and I really think this was a curveball of a wine, you know? This was a hard wine to pinpoint, and talking about Chardonnay being, you know, full circle here, the winemaker's wine... That there are choices here we didn't even discuss. They went from barrel back to stainless steel.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, you couldn't talk about things like how long it was staying in bottle before release, how long it stayed in like an inert vessel like stainless steel after they combine. Because normally, if you're aging in barrels, you're not typically... basically going right from barrel into a bottle. You're going from barrel into some kind of tank to kind of blend all your separate barrels and then from that tank into bottle. So, you know, whether or not that's a you know, 1 week process or a 2 month process, or in this case, it sounds like it was a 6 month process. You know, there's some time span between getting out of your barrel into the bottle, yeah, and that usually ends up in a steel tank.
So I wish I wish we went with 13.5.
Was it 13.2? It's 13.2.
Mm-hmm. So I think we can wrap this tasting up by saying, you know, with no matter how much wine you've drank, no matter how much you know, there's still things to know. And I am super excited, and I think it's awesome that this newfound wine was different than all of the other wines that we tried. And what we really tried to do when we picked those, the first three wines, was get three standard representations of how you can make Chardonnay. And then we got this newfound, and it just completely didn't follow any of the things we'd previously discussed, which is, I think it's exciting because there's still endless options to be explored with winemaking. But also, it kind of keeps us on our toes with, like, yeah, just because we think we know a thing or two about wine, there's still more to know. And I think, you know, some winemakers are pretty artistic. And I think it's fun to be able to participate in this process and you know, directly participate in the process by drinking it.
Exactly. That's the best part of the participation, sure is. Honestly.
So how would you kind of describe
I'd recommend
this?
Anybody to go out, look up the crappy tech sheets that most folks have out there, and try to find a few good ones that actually tell you exactly what they're doing.
I do want to say a disclaimer to winemakers. We are very critical because we need to know. This keeps us up at night, people. So please, nerves rest.
it's fun also from a learning perspective, because I'm like, if you really are trying, like before we even were on here, I was looking up, because this has always been an issue for me, is determining mallow versus lees and oak. And, you know, it's sometimes really difficult to kind of pick them apart. And I was trying to think, like, well, what's the best way to do it if you don't know whether or not they actually did everything else the same except for one piece? Because you're really only trying to, like, take the one piece. And most of the time it was folks comparing different wines. So they would compare, you know, a Pinot Grigio or something, mm-hmm, versus a Chardonnay. And they'd say,
okay. Have you ever done this with Chardonnay?
No, I've never like compared four or five different styles of Chardonnay and actually tried to, you know, notice the differences. But this was really helpful, kind of picking them apart and saying, oh, these are wines that, for the most part, the mallow is there, but you don't perceive them as having the same degree of mallow. And, so, you know, the Terlan, whatever it is, clearly did not. It said partial, whatever that means. And Newfound didn't say anything on it specifically, so I don't know.
Maybe,
but I'm going to guess that the fact that it's Cali, it's highly likely it's going through mallow.
Maybe they took that for granted, that, you know, that it's from California, just what you said, that
yeah,
we're assuming that it is.
I think
mallow.
That's probably the case, but I would highly recommend that, you know, if anybody's thinking about trying to understand differences between the impacts of mallow and lees aging and, you know, oak influence, you know, if you can find some recommendations on the Chardonnay space, a good one that I was trying to actually have here for tonight, because it was, you know, it saw concrete and oak, but it did not go through mallow, was Zuccardi. A Chardonnay.
From Argentina.
Yeah, from Argentina.
Oh,
and so
man,
that would have been a great one here because it doesn't see mallow, but it does go through the, you know, concrete and oak.
Next
and,
time we
and
hang
it's like
out,
14
doing,
something alcohol. So it's kind of a bigger wine.
It's
as
hotter
well, so
down
it's a hotter,
there.
Riper.
It's super hot.
So I'm like, how does that compare to the Chardonnay you're getting from Cali in this example, where, you know, those also saw more ripeness, but they were, you know, more mallow and had influences of a bigger, rounder body. So I don't know. I think it's a fun experiment, and it definitely helps your, you know, ability to perceive the differences on the palate.
Absolutely. And I also want to, just before we close, I want to challenge all the people who say I don't like Chardonnay, because that doesn't mean anything to me. Because Chardonnay can be made in tons of different styles. And when you say you don't like Chardonnay, what kind of Chardonnay do you mean? Whenever, you know, if you ask someone and they say, I don't like Chardonnay, well, what kind of Chardonnay? They can't answer that question. You know, so yeah. I want to challenge people. If you are someone who says you don't like Chardonnay, the reason why I'm challenging you is because I want you to enjoy life
he
more.
He is directly challenging me because I oftentimes say I don't like
Chardonnay. No, you don't. You like Chardonnay.
Well, I like Chablis, but...
But there's so much Chardonnay can do, and I think... you know, try it all before you
buy it.
Before you buy it. Well, I want to thank all of the winemakers who made this wine possible for us to drink. Thank you, and thank you to our listeners for sticking with us until the bitter end.
And good night.
This has been another episode of Four Glasses to Finish Chardonnay. The winemaker's wine. Listening to this episode, we hope you learned as much as we did making the episode. Follow us on Instagram at Four Glasses to Finish with the number 4, and subscribe to our podcast pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts. And remember, the best wine is wine that is shared.